Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to begin with the latest on healing with some really exciting information on intravenous vitamin C prior to elective percutaneous coronary intervention and what that means. Also, the latest on antioxidants reducing oxidative stress, what that means. How vitamin E can protect against your DNA strand breakage, that's a big issue. And new compounds discovered that are hundreds of times more mutagenic and that we're consuming on a regular basis. That's not a good thing, but it's important we know it so we can avoid those items. Curcumin and boswellia show promise with a major disease. And epigenetics, a new link between nutrition and cancer. Well, good, they finally got around to it. I'll tell you about that. Also, want a better work-life balance? I'll tell you what you need for that. Then from our environmental segment today, we're going to look at, did 100,000 bats just fall out of the sky yesterday in Australia? What was that about? Global warming. Scientists predict a lack of honeybees will lead to a food crisis. And NASA announces today, yeah, what we were talking about for the last year and a half, a coronal mass ejection. It's coming. An X1 flare is going to hit the Earth's magnetic atmosphere today. The speed of the solar wind will spike at about 1.6 million miles per hour. And according to NOAA, the Space Weather Prediction Center, they're going to tell us about what that will mean. But it will likely, quote, cause geomagnetic storm interruptions. Now, this is from NASA. So for those of you who thought, oh, that's just nonsense. No, it's real. And solar storms hitting us today. And thank goodness it won't be a giant one, but it'll still cause some problems, which means, one, what would you do if you got hit with a big one? We all want to galvanize all independent thinkers into joining us in fighting the fast-tracking of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Well, right now, three legislators have pushed it into a position where it can be fast-tracked. So after 20 years of NAFTA poverty, the lawmakers are moving to fast-track this disaster. I'll tell you who these people are and why we should be on the phones registering our complaints today. And from commentary time, fundamentalism. Now, most people will recognize a religious fundamentalist, but what about the psychological problems of being a fundamentalist? I remember once, way back at the beginning of my career, I was in Atlanta, Georgia. I was debating five different doctors on the simple issue of organic versus non-organic. Now, I didn't have the scientific qualifications. I was not yet an author of scientific papers. This was at the beginning of my career, and I guess they thought since I had this monster best-selling book and was appearing everywhere, that I'd be easy to destroy, and therefore this movement would die with me. So I was invited for dozens of debates. Every week I was asked to come debate someone somewhere on this issue of health. They said there was nothing wrong with the American diet, sugar wasn't harmful, mercury wasn't harmful, fluoride wasn't harmful, DDT wasn't harmful, nothing was harmful. Oh, occasionally over-smoking cigarettes might be harmful. And that was it. Everything else was in your genes. And so I prepared as much information as I could on the topic of sugar, and I had it all from peer-reviewed literature. At the end of this one-hour televised debate, I offered each of the gentlemen there the research, and they looked at me and laughed. And one of them in particular said something that just stuck in my mind all these years. He said, You have your truths and we have ours. But we're the ones who will be respected and you won't be. You'll be forgotten. We're the medical doctors. We're the people who the media go to. You're a nobody. And it was the, and it doesn't matter what people think of me, but it does matter when they say, you have your truths and I have ours. I thought we should all be looking for a universal truth. That's the basis of fundamentalism. So now you know some of the frustrations for those of us, Carlton Fredericks, Gaylord Houser, Lelore Cardell, Adele Davis, the hundreds of very noble people who came before me and who provided a platform for at least discussing health, and even Bernard McFadden before them, and yet their truths would never be accepted by the official truth. That means that official policies, whether they're in education, politics, from the right or left, whether they're in human behavior, these are fundamentalist. And that's why they don't change their mind. That's why you can have a very realistic argument. You can have the truth on your side, a universal truth. You can have irrefutable proof on your side. And it won't budge a fundamentalist. But remember, we're not talking about religious fundamentalism now. We're talking about the psychopathology of fundamentalism. And if time permits, I will share a commentary by Robert Burroughs from Countercurrents and myself on this. My guest in the second part of our program continues with the new year of motivating people to become a part of the new social transformation movement at the grassroots level. Kevin Zeese, Z-E-E-S-E. He's an attorney and a political activist. He is co-director of It's Our Economy, director of Come Home America, an organizer for the national occupation of Washington, D.C., and one of the original developers of Occupy Washington. He's worked for 30 years on drug policy reform and serves as the president of the organization Common Sense on Drug Policy. In 2006, he ran on the Maryland ballot for the U.S. Senate on the Maryland Green Party, and he was Ralph Nader's press secretary for his 2004 presidential campaign. He also challenged the Chamber of Commerce and Karl Rove's America Crossroads organization, seeking to overturn Citizens United. And so we are going to talk about re-energizing social transformative movements. I don't know how much of all this we're going to get in, but we're going to try. Let's begin. There's new information about new types of vitamin C that are in development that I'm aware of, and they will literally replace intravenous vitamin C. Orally, that's a big plus, because I used to sit there myself for 4 hours with a vitamin drip to see what would happen to my body if I took 200,000 milligrams of vitamin C a day as a healthy, dynamic individual in my biochemistry who had never smoked, never drank, never taken any medications, drugs, and always athletic, what would it do, and a vegan? And that helped me develop protocols that I then shared with the medical staff at the Tri-State Healing Center to help thousands of individuals, and specifically to help a lot of people who I work with who had AIDS-defining illnesses, to keep them alive and actually reverse their illnesses and give them quality of life. Now, there's new information on intravenous vitamin C. Here it is. This is from an article. Quote, and I'll just show you the science, and I'll break it into lay language. And this is from the effect of intravenous vitamin C infusion on periprocedural myocardial injury for patients undergoing elective precutaneous coronary intervention. Well, what that means in lay language is this was a study where half the patients received vitamin C intravenous over a period of time, but 6 hours before an elective precutaneous coronary intervention surgery. The other group received just saline, salt water. And they found that the group that received the vitamin C was substantially protected, did not have the post-operative problems. So that's a big plus. And here's the title of the article. Intravenous vitamin C prior to elective precutaneous coronary intervention may help prevent a periprocedural myocardial injury, meaning a lot of people have heart attacks after surgery, during surgery, on their heart. This can help prevent that. We're talking about saving thousands, hundreds of thousands of lives. This is just really terrific. So that's good. Next up, and so all those people who were using intravenous vitamin C, they were all right because they knew what vitamin C did. And a lot of people had used vitamin C prior to some of the surgeries on heart disease. Next up, we know we should be taking antioxidants, full-spectrum antioxidants. The more you get, the better it is. This is a study from the Human Nutrition Laboratory Institute of Food Nutrition, Zurich, Switzerland. Quote, antioxidant supplements reduce oxidative stress and stabilize liver function test. All right, and so if you want to help stabilize your liver function, those of you who may have sclerosis of the liver, hepatitis, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, then take your antioxidants, like vitamin C, vitamin E, selenium. Those were the ones that were used in this study, but there are a lot of other. I would have used glutathione. That is singularly the most important antioxidant for your liver. But it shows it helps them. Now, we know that one of the ways we get old and diseased is our DNA is damaged and there's not enough restorative chemicals in our body to keep up with the damage. But because we start with an enormous supply, we assume that we'll have plenty. Well, it depends upon what you do to either speed up or slow down this damage process, and also what do you do that goes beyond simply slowing down the damage to actually restoring the DNA. So if you just ate the regular American diet, but you didn't eat extra calories, so therefore you weren't obese, and if you didn't rush your meals, so you took your time, even if the food you were eating was not healthy, you would slow down the progression of disease, but you wouldn't prevent any disease. Sooner or later, you're still going to have your heart attacks, stroke, cancers, and other conditions. But if you actually ate or drank things that reverse DNA damage, then you're turning that life glass of sand upside down. You're starting over. And that's the science we have today. In fact, I've been invited to speak in the spring in a couple of months on my newest clinical study and to a group of thousands of scientists. And I'm looking forward to it. These are anti-aging scientists. Because when you go there, you hear all these wonderful stories about what people are doing that never make it into the news media, mostly never make it into a scientific journal. So stopping your DNA from being damaged, repairing it when it is damaged, that's the key. This is the latest study on this. This is just one example. And this is from Tabriz University School of Medicine, the Department of Pharmacology and Toxicology, quote, anti-mutagenic effects of vitamin E on oncology and non-oncology hospital nurses by COMET assay. Now, in lay language, what the study showed was that the group of nurses that took vitamin E, 200 milligrams each day, and these were oncology nurses, cancer nurses, they had less DNA strand breakage. And that's very good. Now, mind you, if they're getting 20% protection with 200 units, imagine if they're where I would be at 1,000 units, and not just from alpha tocopherol, but mixed tocopherols with tocotrienols, and also vitamin C and vitamin D, and other nutrients that are known to protect the DNA. Well, then it wouldn't be 20%, but at least it's showing how you can help protect your DNA from breaking, which leads to disease and pain, with just vitamin E alone. Now, another single nutrient made major impact, and that was fish oil. Fish oil supplementation protects pulmonary function and reduces airway inflammation induced by high-fat meal. The article, quote, I'll quote directly from the article from the Department of Kinesiology, Kansas State University, and here's what it says. The effect of short-term fish oil supplementation on pulmonary function and airway inflammation following a high-fat meal. And then it goes on to show that this was a double-blind, placebo-controlled study in asthmatic people, hence the idea of pulmonary. And they were average only 22 years old. And they took 3,000 milligrams, that's the right dose, for 3 weeks. And it was found, quote, to protect against increased airway inflammation induced by consuming a high-fat meal. After consumption of a high-fat meal, quote, levels of triglycerides were increased in both groups as compared to pre-meal levels. The percent increase in airway inflammation assessed via fractional exhaled nitric oxide was greater in the group that received the placebo versus the group that received the fish oil, which means, in lay language, if you have asthma, bronchitis, any form of obstructive pulmonary condition, then you should seek the anti-inflammatories for your lungs, including, as this study shows, fish oil. And finally, two things. One is that Oregon State University, as published in Environmental Science and Technology, showed that we are consuming a great many chemicals. And they're found in vehicle exhaust, but also they're found in grilled meat. They're 100 times more mutagenic than their parent compounds, which are known carcinogens. Quote, these compounds, from Oregon State University, quote, these compounds were not previously known to exist and raise additional concerns about the health impacts of heavily polluted urban air or dietary exposure. It's not yet been determined in what level the compounds might be present, and no health standards now exist for them, but we're consuming them. So, one more reason to understand that when you're eating foods that are grilled, barbecued, deep fried, you're consuming these mutagenic properties. And, quote, some of the compounds we've discovered are far more mutagenic than we previously understood. Yeah, well, then eat a living, healthy diet, and you won't have those. And try to get more time in the country, and you'll have cleaner air. And finally, for those of you who have any kidney problems or know someone who does, from the Journal of Complementary and Integrative Medicine, researchers at Baylor University found that they could substantially reduce inflammation in the kidneys of patients who had kidney disease by using curcumin and boswellia. And that is important. I mentioned boswellia recently and curcumin yesterday. Quote, from the study, our findings partially support previous research on the anti-inflammatory effects of curcumin and boswellia serrata. So that's good. So that's one more thing that we can do to help those who have kidney disease. You want to have a better work life? Exercise. Quote, researchers have found that exercise plays a role in how individuals feel they can manage their work-life balance. Individuals who exercise regularly were more confident they could handle the interaction of their work and home life and were less likely to be stressed at work. Okay, that's good. That was from Human Resource Management Magazine, peer-reviewed journal. And finally, from Science Daily, as published in the peer-reviewed journal Nutrition and Cancer, and it says, the epigenetics, a new link between nutrition and cancer. Quote, nutrition on epigenetic mechanisms may help to predict an individual's susceptibility to cancer, provide dietary recommendations, provide therapeutic applications of natural compounds to fight against cancer. Quote, epigenetic modifications are heritable and potentially reversible changes in gene expression that do not require changes to the actual DNA sequence. By taking advantage of these modifications, researchers believe it's possible to mediate environmental signals and provide a link between susceptible genes and environmental factors in the cause of cancer, end quote. Well, here you have it, a major peer-reviewed journal, a major study showing what many of us have been saying for a long time. And I simply want to say thank you, Dr. Lawrence LeShan. I knew Lawrence LeShan. We were friends. I was a very young scientist. I was a novice working at the Institute of Applied Biology. He was the older, senior, wise man. And we had many conversations about what a person thinks, what they eat, what they drink, where they live, will determine their percentage of cancer. And this was in completely healthy people. I remember once he did a study. I watched this study. He interviewed 1,000 healthy women who had no history of cancer in their families, or did they have cancer? And then he predicted over a five-year period the percentage likely to develop breast cancer based upon their emotions. And I found this fascinating because I had no background in anything like this. And I said, what is your predictive gold standard? And he said, if they feel unappreciated, if they feel used, abused, if they feel as if they don't have a voice or they have no respect or no love, they're more likely to process the energy in the body. And he says, Gary, you're from the South. I said, yes. He said, you're familiar with the Christian doctors. I said, of course, everyone is in the South. And he said, you know, we have no Christian doctors up north here. He said, where the doctor will sit at your bedside and hold your hand and pray with you. And it has a remarkable impact upon how the patient feels, how much longer they live, the quality of their life. And he said, what do you think's happening there? And I said, well, clearly some form of energy exchange. And he said, that's correct. He said, the future of medicine that will be meaningful will be energy medicine. And that was the first time in my life anyone had ever used the words energy medicine. I would later have a conversation with Hans Selye, the father, the pioneer in all of the area of work in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s of de-stress and the personalities that absorb stress and manifest it into disease. Stress is not harmful, he said. Distress is. The energy of excitement can be stressful in a good way, and the energy of stress that is negative is harmful, an exchange of energy. And it was from these beginnings that we now look today, and they're telling us today in new studies, and that's not the only study, that, hey, what you think, how you approach life, the attitude you wake up with, the food you put in your body, the beverages you put in your body, the conversations you have, all will determine the epigenetics of disease or wellness. So I'm glad that these people who I had the great privilege of meeting at the early part of my life, and they were at the end of their lives, understood this. It's unfortunate they didn't live long enough to see, wow, they were right. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment, we have a lot to go on the environment, on commentaries, and a guest. And then I'm going to open our lines for TalkBack. I'm going to save the last 5 minutes of the program for TalkBack. That's where you can call in and share your thoughts and comments and points of view. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. You know I can be found sitting home all alone. If you can't come around, at least please telephone. Don't be cruel to who heart is true. Baby, if I made you mad for something I might have said, please don't forget my past. The future looks bright ahead. Don't be cruel to who heart is true. I don't want no other love, baby, it's just I'd like to welcome all of you to this program. We're going to go to health and nutrition. Then we're going to do my guest. But I want to start with a commentary. I shared some of my own thoughts on fundamentalism. And I want to also share those of Robert J. Burroughs from Countercurrents. You see, for those of us who have always wondered, why is it that when people say, show us the truth, and we do, a universal truth, not a political, individualized truth, not a polemic, not an ideological reference point, but something that we can all agree upon, that it does not move them. What does it take to open a mind? What does it take to communicate? Can you have a healthy relationship where one person is thinking as a fundamentalist on issues and the other is thinking with an open mind? And that's frequently the confusion we have, where we all say we want something similar, but then we refuse to cooperate and to go forward as a unified front. Fundamentalism, in my personal opinion, is a major underlying cause of a lot of our problems. Now, yes, power, greed, sociopathology and personalities, the outcome being fascism, a police state, totalitarianism, the people engaged at different levels of this whole effort, the bureaucrats, the technocrats, the plutocrats, the oligarchs, they're all working together because they all have something to gain, and there's a hierarchical structure that they work within. And then there's the rest of us, who then are either benefited or we are lessened by what they do. Yet, how do we end up telling a police officer, why are you putting handcuffs on a 6-year-old boy and arresting him because he kissed the hand of his little girlfriend? He doesn't even know about sex, and now he's being arrested as a sexual offender? You have to be a fundamentalist in order to allow that to happen. When the Occupy people were holding flowers, and I was there, and asking for open dialogue, and they're maced and beaten, you have to be a fundamentalist in order to do the beating, and you have to be open-minded to seek to resolve the issues and look beyond your own personal needs or gains, angers, or your essentialness to that cause. It is often manifest in a religious context. Now, that makes it very visible. But there are plenty of secular fundamentalists, too. If we're to understand fundamentalism, we should not view it just as a religious problem. It is also a psychological problem. I grew up with it. I saw it in so many people who had an opinion of anyone new who moved into our, you know, working-class neighborhood. So what is fundamentalist? A fundamentalist is usually considered to be a person who adheres strictly to a doctrine or a viewpoint or a set of principles that are considered original and pure. And therein is the deception, because this doctrine might be theological in nature. For the fundamentalists, many of their beliefs and their behaviors that arise from them will, at least in theory, be derivative of their fundamental doctrine. And for the fundamentalist, there is no room to consider views that are at variance with their accepted doctrine, and contrary views will usually either be dismissed out of hand or resisted with considerable vigor and often violence. One example. I have been invited to many scientific conferences of some of the most outstanding scientists in the world because of my original 47 different clinical studies. And just as one example, where in Washington, D.C., thousands of scientists who were showing the progress they were making on different stem cells, and they're wanting grants. If only they, you know, had enough money, they could prove that they could affect the mitochondria in the brain and therefore help someone with ADHD or someone with Alzheimer's or someone with autism spectrum disorder live a little better life, have some of their symptoms controlled. So instead of doing my pre-planned lecture, I just invited out on the stage Jonathan Ortega and his mother and father, two New York City police officers, 20 years on the force. I invited out Marie McGovern, former professor at New York University, mastered background in the classical arts, and as one of the top people of discussing the value of art in history on all levels, and a woman who had reversed all of her menopausal symptoms and had gone from postmenopause to premenopause. And they didn't know what to expect. And so when I explained to them that we're not talking about DNA, mitochondria, or stem cells, we're talking about Gaia. Everything integrated, everything interrelated, and here's the outcome. And these are not the only examples. Reversing Alzheimer's, reversing autism completely, and reversing menopause completely. And there was just stunned silence in the room. And then each person spoke about their improvements. And John talked about how now he likes to play the guitar, and he likes to make breakfast for his mom and dad, and how he's number one in his class in a regular school now. And how this woman who couldn't remember her name, who had Alzheimer's, is now functioning and helping other Alzheimer's. She's helped thousands of people who are struggling by giving him advice and helping him in some direction. So then when we went out in the hallway afterwards, it was just a sea of scientists. How'd you do it? What'd you do? What'd you do? And I said, I'll be happy to share all the protocols, all of the insights. And I handed out cards with phone numbers. Not one person called me. Not one person called or followed up with the people there. Not one. Why? Why, when what they were working on, we had achieved? It would be no different than when I had 100 people who had improved or reversed their full-blown AIDS, had their medical doctors, their medical records. It took us a year and a half to organize it. We had a press conference. We had an astute scientific panel. And 9 of the people were my own work people that I had worked with who had full-blown AIDS, who had reversed completely all their medical records, and not a single member of the AIDS community, the scientific community, or the media showed up. 7,000 invitations, not one showed up. But they were all certain that whatever we were doing wouldn't be right. Those are just two examples in medicine and in science of fundamentalism and the psychological implications of what happens when you meet people who are living through a fundamentalism paradigm and therefore cannot allow you to infect their purity, their certainty, their absolute doctrine. That is why we do not see change that we need and should. In contrast to the fundamentalist, a person who is open-minded may still hold strong views and perhaps even have a strong conscientious position on certain issues and be impassioned by it. Good for them. Dylan Radigan, he's at the top of my list of a person I respect for putting himself on the line for the passion of his views. They will usually behave in accordance with those views and in the process match it with their conscience. However, despite this, they will usually also demonstrate a willingness to seriously contemplate an alternative view or a course of action before discarding it. And moreover, they are likely to accept suffering in one form or another as the outcome of their conscientious position. They're true heroes, in my opinion, because they know that there's going to be emotional or political or social violence against anyone who offers authentic change. Fundamentalism is a religious guise, is both widespread and problematic. For example, Christian fundamentalists play a crucial role in shaping U.S. domestic policies in relation to abortion, gay marriage, and theories of evolution, as well as U.S. imperial and military policy. Jewish fundamentalism is a key driver of Islamic domestic and foreign policy, including in relation to Palestine. And Islamic fundamentalism, especially the Wahhabi variety, drives attitudes towards women and foreign policies in countries such as Saudi Arabia. Hindu fundamentalism manifests as a form of religious nationalism in India, and Buddhist fundamentalism right now, unfortunately, is driving violence against the Muslim population in Burma. And while religious fundamentalism is recognizable in most people, fundamentalism has many non-religious manifestations as well. And these are widespread, even if they often occur in less readily identifiable ways. Moreover, fundamentalist behavior is readily observed in individuals as well as in groups. One example of fundamentalist behavior is the parent or teacher who believes that obedience is an unquestionable, desirable trait, that all commands, rules, and laws are right beyond question, and that children and students should be admonished to obey all rules unthinkingly. Another example is the wealthy person who believes that money is the measure of all that has value and is not able to share in any of that. Psychologically, a fundamentalist is a person with an intense fear of being wrong. And that is an intense fear of being judged to hold the wrong view or to engage in the wrong behavior. And this intense fear of being wrong develops during childhood when one or both parents and probably teachers dogmatically refuse to listen to the child, thus denying it the chance to develop its own views and moral code, while also terrorizing the child into believing and adapting a particular set of values and beliefs and behaving in a particular manner. If you doubt me, then come speak with some of the people I've counseled about how their religion or their parents or their social standing was influenced by how they were treated and how they were emotionally abused if they didn't fall into line. No open-mindedness there. The only thing you have is an intense fear of being wrong that marks out the fundamentalist form the person who is open-minded of consciousness would rebel against. Fundamentalism is a significant social problem, particularly in some contexts, and to fix it, we need to recognize its psychological origin. Unfortunately, however, this is not easy to do because the terror that holds their value and belief system in place and drives their behavior is deeply hidden within the individual's psyche. I'm Gary Knoll. Something to think about. In a moment, my guest, and who's standing by, and we're going to talk about social movements. Just a couple things on the environment. 100,000 bats fall out of the sky in Australia due to extreme heat wave. Remember I talked about it yesterday? From Rod Basnalmer, quote from Aldernet, in a scene that could come straight out of Alfred Hitchcock's imagination, about 100,000 bats were found littering the ground after a major heat wave hit Australia this week, causing the bats to fall from the sky and die upon impact. In addition to the bats, the heat wave, which struck the northeast state of Queensland earlier this week and hit temperatures of 135 degrees. By the way, that doesn't include what it's like on the ground. That's the ambient heat. On the ground, it could be 150. Meant mass deaths for the country's flying foxes in 25 different colonies. Quote, over 43 degrees Celsius, by the way, that's 109 degrees Fahrenheit, they just fall, said a conservation worker. We're just picking up those that are just not coping and humanely euthanizing them. That's just one more consequence. Remember I said you will have the hottest day and the coldest day happening simultaneously in the universe, the driest area and the wettest area, all because of climate change. And by the way, on my next program, I'm going to talk about the harassment of a climate scientist, which needs to stop. The climate scientist has been threatened at every level, and I want to show you what happens when a climate scientist tells the truth and the different groups that go after that scientist. And also, we're now looking at the destruction of honeybees. Quote, a lack of honeybees is causing a crisis in agriculture, with scientists confirming there are not enough bees to pollinate crops. The Department of Agriculture, quote from Chris Kerrigan of the Daily Shuffle.com, is worried about the honeybees in the United States. Colony collapse disorder has resulted in the loss of tens of millions of bees countrywide and has left scientists worrying about food security. Pesticides are causing huge concerns, and scientists have said they are contributing to the die-off. with some predicting that if it continues, there will be a threat to the U.S. food supply. Even the weather plays a part, with some beekeepers reporting massive die-offs in cold winters. Well, I'm a beekeeper. I'm a certified organic farmer. I'm a conservationist. I'm an environmentalist. I grow all year round. I have bees. I've had bees for 35 years. Never had a colony collapse. Nor have the other organic farmers. Gee whiz, you think that maybe the orthodox fundamentalist scientists and bureaucrats ought to look at what some of us are doing and say, if their colonies are not collapsing, why are ours? Then they'd learn. And we're going to get hit today with a solar storm, according to NASA. This is from NASA. The NOAA is predicting a geomagnetic storm later today as the coronal mass ejection from X1 flare hits the Earth's magnetosphere. The speed of the solar storm will spike at around 1.6 million miles per hour. The Weather Prediction Center has followed information for the 9th, 10th, and 11th of this month and talks about what it's going to do. It won't be the big devastating one, but it will be disrupting some things, and so at least for those of you who thought it wouldn't happen, it is today. Finally, before we go to our guest, just a comment. I was informed last evening by the program director of our sister station, where I've been for 31 years, Tony Bates, that I am no longer to be an advocate on the air for my audience, and therefore my voice will no longer be there to defend the audience and to advocate on its behalf. And that's fine, not a problem. For those of you who know the phone numbers, you can continue listening every single day over the telephone, and you can listen every single day over Progressive Radio Network. And for those of you who have not received your premiums, which is unfortunate, from August or more likely October or December, I've set up someone who will help as best we can. We will continue to be there on your behalf and try to see that you get what you had supported the station with. You gave them your money. You have not received your premiums. That's unfortunate. Here is the email, Mila, that's M-I-L-L-A, at GaryNall.com. I'll give you a phone number. This is for, not for BAI, because BAI is making a diligent effort to get premiums up to date. And a lot of volunteers, Mitch Cohen and Bertold, a lot of people are involved in trying to see that you are made whole on your premiums. Not the case at PFW. You can call from PFW if you have not received your premiums, 646-926-5433, 646-926-5433, and Mila will work with you on trying to see that you get your premiums, all right? And for those who pay attention to such a thing, when I Googled Pacifica Radio Network today, there were about 233,000 search results, which is good. When I Googled Progressive Radio Network search results, there were 21 million, which is good. People should pay attention to the future. Honor the audience first. And you'll have an audience tomorrow. Let's say hello to my guest who is standing by to take us through the section of our program now. I've given you his background, Kevin Zeese. Nice to have you with us today, Kevin.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you, Gary.
I'd like to begin our conversation about mobilizing citizens and local communities into more proactive efforts to push back government and corporate domination of our lives. By noting a recent Gallup poll published this week, the poll shows that 42% of Americans claim to be independent and don't identify with either the corporate Republicans or corporate Democrats. However, among this 42%, there would still be stressful ideologies and belief systems that prevent them from actually uniting into any kind of effective coalition to challenge the duopoly in Washington. And ideologies aside, there's still sufficient common ground between libertarians, independent Tea Partiers, Greens and socialists, liberals and all, and conservatives, authentic conservatives, to agree upon many issues. You don't have to agree upon everything. And this idea that, once again, you're either all pure like what I believe in, or you shouldn't be considered at all, I think that has just been so short-sighted. Select something you can have in common and go forward with that. Oh, by the way, yesterday I was quoting Dr. Joseph Marcola of what he's advocating, and he eats meat, and he was advocating a grass-fed beef and pork and chicken and turkey and fish. That was not me. I'm a vegan. I was quoting his diet approach. Anyhow, sorry for that little aside. So take us on this journey of getting America to start to work together in a way that we can work from the grassroots up and we can start to make a difference.
Well, it's a really interesting question. I mean, that recent poll by Gallup is part of a longer-term trend of people turning away from the two parties. It didn't just come from 0 to 42%. It's been a gradual process, and it's consistent with other polls that show no respect for Congress, down sometimes as low as single-digit respect, especially for the Republican Party lately. But you're right, there's a lot of views among that. But we're at a really interesting stage of the evolution of the social movement that is really challenging this corporatist government. And that's something that is a lot of those categories of people that you mentioned would agree with, that, you know, we don't want a corporatist-controlled government. We don't want an economy that is the government and big business working together to take as much as they can while keeping everybody else poor. I mean, there's a lot of agreement on that. When you go through a social movement, there's the stage that we're currently in is a stage where you're trying to develop national consensus. And that's a big grassroots process, as you mentioned. It starts in the bottom and works its way up. It's a grassroots process of people talking to each other, people listening to radio shows like yours, people on social media sharing ideas, and it gradually results in widespread support. The initial area of support is opposing the current system, and that's what that 42% figure is starting to show, is that opposition to the current system. And, you know, a lot of people register as Democrats or Republicans because that's the only way to affect who runs for those parties in the primary. So even it's probably even higher than that, those who have problems with the two corporate parties. And so we can see on a whole range of issues where the public is agreeing that what's going on right now is not working. The wealth divide, the healthcare system, the food systems, just the ecology of the planet, like you were talking about the Australian bats falling from the sky and the extreme weather variations that exist. All this people are starting to see and realize that what we're doing now is not working. So that's where you get your first consensus. The secondary consensus, a consensus that takes a little longer, of course, is what do we do about it? And we're still, people are gradually coming to some ideas on there. And that's our task right now as a social movement, is to develop that kind of national consensus that what we have right now is not working and that there are better alternatives that we should move toward quickly. And that's really the task of the social movement that we're in.
Good. And I'm confident in it, too. In your roadmap for social change, you rely upon the writings of the activist and the social theorist Bill Moyers, not the Bill Moyers on PBS, who outlined stages of positive popular movements to affect positive social change. Where do you believe we are at now, and particularly with respect to what you write as the, quote, misalignment of ideals and reality, which yes, many who were involved in the Occupy movement likely experienced and hampered the movement as it was at its height?
Really good question. Bill Moyer, and that's without an S, Bill Moyer, not Bill Moyers with an S. Bill Moyer was a social justice activist who started in the 60s up until his death in 2002. He was worked with Martin Luther King. He was a staff member with Dr. King in the anti-poverty campaign that he was working on. And so he was involved in anti-war movements, anti-nuclear, a whole range of things. And when he was imprisoned with 1,400 others at Seabrook protesting nuclear plants, he started to develop this idea of the eight stages of social movements. This was back in the 70s. He put it into an article in 1987 and into a book in 2001, the year before he died. And it's really remarkable. We had read this before, and then Margaret Flowers and I revisited it recently, and it was amazing to see how well he described what we've been going through with our current movements. the first few stages are kind of the buildup, but stage four is the takeoff. And that's when you see a mass number of protests across the country that just spring up and raise a new issue to consciousness that was off the political agenda. And that really describes Occupy very well. It raised the idea of the wealth divide, the crutch in our economic system, the dysfunction of our government because of money. It was a real rise up against Wall Street and the rule of money. And that then got put on the agenda and became part of the political discussion. You saw political candidates and politicians, even President Obama, who during his term, the wealth divide's gotten so much worse, but even he started to sound like an occupier in some of his speeches talking about the wealth divide. And you had Bill de Blasio ride that wave to his victory in the New York mayoral race. But after the takeoff phase, stage five is the phase of defeat, where you feel like you've lost, the movement's disappeared, you've accomplished nothing, you see it was a waste of time, it didn't do anything. But in fact, in stage five, you also recognize that, in fact, you did a lot. You raised consciousness on an issue, you put it on the agenda, and that's very significant. So it wasn't a failed movement. It was a stage of movement. You can't expect a woman to go from conception to delivery. She has to go through 9 months. You can't expect a kindergartner to be doing physics. They have to go through elementary school, middle school, and up to college. I mean, it's natural to have phases. That's the way life works, and especially to with movements where you're changing us, transforming a society, and there are people who profit from the status quo who are going to push back, try to protect their interests, and people who are just seeing it happen and getting educated. So the next stage, which we're in right now, is stage six. Stage seven, by the way, is success. That's when you win. Stage six is the stage, as I said earlier, where you're trying to build national consensus from the ground up with a broad-based grassroots movement. We are seeking to get, and you will get, 80% support for your views by the time that stage is finished. Now, this stage is not a quick stage. It's a stage that is, could be a decade long or more. It could be years. We don't know how far we're into it, so it may be shorter than we think, but the job right now is to build that broad-based movement. And I think that one of the key jobs of those trying to create that movement is to separate a myth and reality so people can see the truth of what's happening around them and not be fooled by the propaganda and the very sophisticated media that misleads them, or the politicians who mislead them. You know, President Obama saying the Obamacare is to provide health care to all. It's not providing health care at all. It's not providing affordable health care. It's providing mass subsidies to the insurance industry. It's a neoliberal model that enriches the for-profit health care complex and diminishes the health care of the public good. And so there's a real inconsistency. You're seeing it right now, by the way, the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is a critical issue for all of us to focus on, especially in the next month. The politicians who support it are saying it's a job-creating treaty. In fact, all these kinds of bills, NAFTA, for example, lost 1 million jobs, undermined the economy of Mexico and the agrarian economy of Mexico, and really created a lot of the immigration problems that we saw in the United States. And that's true with every one of these treaties. They don't create jobs. They lose jobs. They make the oligarchs and the wealthy rich and make the workers poorer. And so it's really a job-killing trade bill, not a job-creating trade bill. And so it's a constant effort, because so often, it's almost never where the government actually says what it's doing. You know, we're going to war for democracy, not for oil, right? It's a constant effort to correct that myth with facts and pierce the propaganda that really surrounds us. We are a very myth-based culture through our history and through our current news, mass news media.
Final question and comment for you, Kevin. I believe that we're at a very healthy place for progressive-minded people of all political and religious and cultural and social and educational backgrounds, because we can all agree we want healthier food. Hence, we should be opposed to genetic engineering and fighting for the right to have it either limited to being, let's say, labeled, so we know if we're buying it or not. We should also be closing down all the nuclear facilities. We should be stopping gas hydrofracking. We should be stopping the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Atlantic Treaty as well. These are something that all of us can agree. So I think it's in time that we go to the sources of information, educate ourselves so that we have good, solid information, and then join coalitions at the grassroots level and start sharing this with other Americans wherever possible. By the way, last week, just on the Progressive Radio Network's website on information on articles, we had 267,313 people come and download information. That's a lot of people.
That's fantastic.
And over 1 million people watched documentaries on public social issues like genetic engineering and vaccines. So if many different people share information from many different sources on the same theme, then we, the people, begin to inspire one another, share with one another, cross-pollinate with one another, and we become viable to the body politic. Your final thoughts?
I totally agree with you on that. I mean, on Popular Resistance, which is our website that brings the movement together, we take it one step further. We also want people to see how, if they're concerned about food, they should also be concerned about health care. If they're concerned about health care, they should also be concerned about energy. That all these issues are connected. That we should be in solidarity with each other, because when we work together, we really can't be defeated. And so I think that's a key fact. I add to everything else I agree with you said. I was just adding that to your comment, that creating solidarity across issues is very critical. Independent media is very important. We have a radio show called Clearing the Fog Radio. We hope we can get on Progressive Network one of these days. And the fog is forces of greed. And what we try to do each week is we try to pierce the forces of greed to get the truth out. And we interview people who are active on various issues to really kind of pierce that fog so people understand what's going on around them. I think that's critical. And I'll just add one more point to you, your comment about how people share. You know, the corporate media used to be so much more dominant than it currently is. We don't realize that we are in a tremendous transition where the corporate mass media is losing viewers, it's losing readers, it's losing credibility, it's losing profits. It's really struggling to figure out how to deal with the current media environment. At the same time that's happening, you're seeing the independent media grow, independent radio grow, you're seeing community television growing, you're seeing the citizens media and the social media growing. I have no doubt that if we can figure out how to coordinate our social and citizens and independent media so that we get messages out in a concerted way, that we can be bigger and more credible and have more viewers and readers and listeners than the corporate media can have.
Well, let me give you an idea of that, Kevin, and then we'll close off our program. Google Progressive Radio. That's for all the Progressive Radio in the world. Progressive Radio Network's number one. So for those people who don't want corporate liberalism or corporate conservatism, they want authentic looks for problems. We have that. So while everyone else was asleep, we were creating coalitions of the can-do and not getting ourselves locked into arguing with one another, which so many people on the left and right do. Thank you very much, Kevin Aziz, for
Thanks
all
for
the
good
work you're doing and the lawsuit you brought to help fight the government and Karl Rove and Citizens United. The website is Come Home America to Us, and also it's
PopularResistance.org.
And it's Kevin Z-Z-E-E-S-E. I'm Gary Noll. We're out of time. Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Sorry I did not have time to go to our talk back. I will do that on Sunday evening, where we'll open the phones so you can have a chance to call in at 8 o'clock Sunday evening, Progressive Radio Network. Have a nice day, everyone. Now let's say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hi, Gary. I just got put in. Hi, very, very quickly. Boy, you know, I'm sitting here in front of my computer while I'm listening, and boy, I got a barrage of emails here. I have people that said that they're still obviously very concerned about this whole Obamacare issue. I have people telling me that they're writing to their congressmen and their senators against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and I would say, I'm not going to count them now, but I have about 7 or 8 people who are actually at your lecture, Empty Your Mind, Fill Your Life. And they said that based on that, they have become complete activists in their communities. I've got people here, a 38-year-old with asthma who was at one of your retreats, who is now, 4 months later, completely reversed their asthma. An 83-year-old, they came to your retreat twice. Came with a walker the first time, second time with a cane. She just walked into my office and said, I'm listening to Gary. This is amazing. She's changed her whole life around. totally healthy, 83 years old. People that are cancer-free. I have a guy that emailed me yesterday. I've been cancer-free for 3 years since I've been on this healthy lifestyle protocol. And he said, "And I am my health care insurance. I don't want someone imposing somebody else's policies on me." So a lot of people are kicking up, and they're disgusted, and they're ready to take action. So it's all good.
That's great. Good. Well, we have a lot of proactivists who are... You're not going to be a qualified activist in the sense you're not going to be taking your time, looking at the issues, educating yourself, and applying not an excessive amount of energy because you don't want to imbalance your life, but rather to complement your life. You want to add something on a daily basis, letter writing, sharing information, sharing films and articles and calls to actions, just enough so that you've committed something to make it a better world. And that's what people are doing because of rebalancing their life. And that's the takeaway message. Thanks a lot, Luann. And let's say hello to Eutrice Lead. Hi, Eutrice. Oh, she'll be there in a minute. All right, I look forward to seeing you all here Sunday evening at 8 p.m. for the Progressive, the Talkback Hour, and then Monday night for the Progressive Commentary Hour, the most downloaded radio program that we know of in radio. Have a nice day, everyone.